Okay, you're very welcome back to the 9 till noon show here on Highland Radio. We're into the second hour this Monday. Some of your comments coming in. I'm very upset to hear that the SUSU grant is not accepted in colleges in the north. I have an autistic child who has her heart set on a particular course that is not available in Letterkenny and was hoping to go to a college in Derry next year. I'd be driving her there and back every day as she wouldn't be capable of catching buses and moving away from home on her own is not an option either. There's no way I'd be able to afford the fees, so it looks like my child won't be able to go on to third level education. I don't know how I'm going to tell her. It's very unfair. Okay, it is, and that's a very difficult story indeed. All these people taking part in Good Friday Agreement are just a talking shop. Jeffrey will never go back into government. Micheál Martin is wasting his time talking about it. The DUP don't want to go into government again with Catholics. They are wasting their time talking waffle. That comes in from John. I'd be slightly more optimistic than you, John. I think after the dust settles, after the local elections, I think they'll have to come up with some sort of an agreement that allows power sharing to resume. Why not compulsory? We know this would save lives. The quad would not roll over on top of the person, just like a tractor. It's a non-brainer. This is in relation to roll cages. I can understand that. I think if you were strapped into the seat of the quad, now I don't really, I think most people have had a go in a quad at some point or other. I'm just wondering if you fall out of the quad, if the roll bar could end up doing more damage than good. I think if you were strapped into the quad, perhaps. But as I say, there's people out there that use them. Let me know. This caller, very sure that a roll bar, compulsory roll bars on quads would save lives. But what do you think? 086 60 25,000. The caller says, no heat off the smoke was coal. If you had a back boiler, it would take ages to heat the radiators. There is a bit of a practicality element to it. I do hear that quite a lot. Were you watching the Grand National on Saturday? It was delayed for a few minutes as people were protesting at it. I've watched it all my life. But last week, and I haven't been reading up any, last Saturday, sorry, I haven't been reading up anything on it, or my mind hasn't been convinced by, you know, people opposed to it or for it. But I'll tell you, maybe it's my age, I don't know. I was watching it, and for the first time, I really thought that I'm not actually enjoying this. It's horrendous, really. Well, horrendous is too strong. Just in terms of seeing the riderless horses crashing into fences and jockeys being flipped in the air and horses having to be put down, Hill 16 died. It was the first time I've kind of thought, I'm not really probably going to watch this again. Now, as I say, I'm not all woke and my views haven't been changed and I haven't been convinced anyway, in any way, shape or form that I'm aware of. But it just was, there was a turning point for me at the weekend. I thought, I'm not really interested in this. Did you find that? 086 60 25,000, 086 60 25,000. And listening to some of the commentary, obviously, I think the trainers and commentators and journalists and those that make money from it, obviously very keen to keep it going and talking about how, you know, it's actually brilliant for the animals and all that type of stuff. And maybe it is. I'm only speaking personally. I'm not trying to change anyone's point of view, but I'm just curious if anyone out there kind of felt the same this year as I did. 086 60 25,000, or not, actually, by the way. I'm not looking to sort of invite people on only with just one certain point of view. That's not the motivation at all. But just in case other people felt that at the same time. You can call us to 07491 25,000, of course, or email comments at highlandradio.com. Later on, Brendan Devaney will be in studio with us, or he might not be. We don't know yet. He'll tell us about 30 seconds before he's due to be here, whether he's going to be in studio or on Zoom. But anyway, be that as it may. Great game of football yesterday, wasn't it? I really enjoyed that. Hopefully next week, the two games featuring Ulster teams will be as exciting. I wouldn't hold my breath. We'll see what Brendan thinks about that. But if you have any points or questions or comments, put to Brendan as well. Listen, he's in plugging his podcast. We'll also get some mileage out of him too if you want to have any questions answered or hear his opinion on anything. That and so much more besides. It's all coming up for you on your 9 till noon show. A new campaign, Get Rare Aware, has been launched by Rare Diseases Ireland to bring together politicians, medical experts and people living with rare diseases, including, of course, here in County Donegal, to take action on under-resourced genetic services at the Department of Clinical Genetics at Children's Health Ireland at Crumlin. Vicky McGrath is CEO of Rare Diseases Ireland and joins us on the programme now. Thanks for your time this morning, Vicky. It's appreciated.
No problem, Greg. Thank you.
Now, I suppose when you, in terms of rare diseases, the name gives it away, doesn't it? Individually, there might be small groups of people suffering from rare diseases, but when taken in totality, it's like 50,000 people living with rare diseases in Ireland. So they're not as rare as a collective, if that makes sense.
Well, actually, yeah, that 50,000 figure is that, in fact, the people living in the regional health area that Donegal is part of.
I'll get so, you, so right? That's not countrywide.
There's about 300,000 in Ireland.
Oh, well, okay. That's even more significant, yeah. Isn't it? And what are the challenges? I beg your pardon, Vicky. What are the challenges? What are the issues then that need to be addressed? I know I referenced it there in the preamble, but why is this so important?
So, I guess a rare disease, as you say, is only a handful of patients for each individual rare disease. There's about 6,000 to 8,000 different rare diseases, and about 70% of those are genetic in origin. So clearly, if you can have a genetic diagnosis, you'll identify what particular rare disease somebody's living with, and that allows proper care, treatment, access to medicines, access to clinical trials, all of those things once you have a genetic diagnosis. But what we find here in Ireland is that our clinical services, our clinical genetic services, based out of Crumlin, that's the main centre for the country, is incredibly under-resourced to the extent that people are about 2 years on a waiting list. And this is 2 years of just waiting to get a diagnosis. Mm. This isn't, 2 years for a procedure or something like that. This is just the simple step of a diagnosis. And so what we're calling on is for the government to deliver. The government in their last programme for government, when they wrote it up in 2020, so almost 3 years ago now, they said that they would provide support to the clinical genetic service at Crumlin. It's specifically written in the programme for government. But 3 years later, nothing has happened. And so what we're saying is, guys, you've got to deliver on this. We can't have people, waiting, unsure what exactly is causing the symptoms that they have. We need to speed up this process and looking to somewhere like Northern Ireland, where that wait is about 3 months.
Well, that's a big difference. And presumably... Yeah, presumably two people then find themselves, without a proper diagnosis, going from one expert or one consultant to another. It's not, in other words, an endless process of elimination when genetic testing presumably could get the correct treatment where available and the correct care in place as soon as possible.
Precisely. So we did some research last year and about 37% are waiting over 5 years for a diagnosis. Some of that is because the research hasn't been done to identify the gene that's causing the symptoms that somebody might be living with. But in many cases, it is because of the delays in getting access to genetics to begin with, and then the delays with the genetic service as well on top of that. And you're absolutely right. People are sitting on multiple waiting lists and being re-referred into different consultants. And it's only adding to the problem that we have with waiting lists in the country. So if we could actually do something like this and get that root cause diagnosis, then people would be on the right path from the get-go. They wouldn't be going from consultant to consultant and being given incorrect treatments, being given the wrong treatments, and potentially even harmful treatments. So there's a lot to be said. And we look at, you look at other areas. I mean, diagnosis is key to the clinical care, period.
It's everything.
Consultants are all crying out for, I need to know what it is in order to be sure that I'm doing the right thing.
Yeah. And do you think everyone that needs to be on that list, albeit facing long delays, gets on that list? Like, is there a, I don't know if the right word is a culture, but is there a proper policy in that, someone that ends up visiting multiple consultants, we still can't get to the root of the problem, right? We better refer you for genetic testing. Does that happen routinely and correctly?
I would say it happens a bit haphazardly. Mm. You might be lucky enough to visit somebody that thinks, let's try this. And we would like to be in a position. So there is a new, genetics and genomic strategy for the country, which was published just towards the end of last year. And that's the 5-10 year vision of and where we will be and what will be happening and stuff like that. And there's a need to, firstly, they call it mainstreaming genetics, so that not everything is centralised in one location, but that different consultants are using genetic services on an ongoing basis. And also to bring genetics into the GP kind of scenario, and, you know, that we all have a better understanding of what genetics means, and when you're, you know, being faced with genetic tests, what does it actually mean? And this is to enable, as you say, that diagnostic piece. Yeah. Because what we find is that people are going from consultant to consultant, and then there's kind of, oh, we don't know what it is, but sure, you'll be grand, or, you know, it's don't worry about it, or whatever. And it's kind of, no, that's not really the right answer. I spoke with somebody the other day, and she was talking about her 38-year-old husband having hip replacements, and they couldn't say, this is the reason why. And then her child was diagnosed with something, and they went back to the husband and said, now we know why you had to have a hip replacement mm-hmm. at the age of 38. And before that, they were kind of, you know, it's just, you're just bad luck kind of thing. Yeah. I said, no, there is a root cause. And with that information now, they can keep an eye on other things for the husband and of for course, the family generally. Yeah. But and that's what it's about. You know, it's about informing, I guess, providing people with the information mm-hmm. and the power to say, I'm going to stay healthy, I'm going to keep an eye on this, I don't need to worry about that type of stuff.
The thing is, you know, though, too, Vicky, and unfortunately we see it all too often, is this policy is costing the state more. I mean, obviously, primarily we're focused on patients and their outcomes and their quality of life. And if you're sitting in pain or with something that's undiagnosed for many, many years, you can only imagine the toll that takes on the individual and those around them. But we're having consultants Absolutely. Seeing people that they don't really need to be seeing, you know, where perhaps other problems that are emerging that perhaps could have been avoided with proper treatment in a timely manner. Again, resources and time within the health service that's if they invested a little bit money in a different area, they would make it back.
Exactly. You're so right. And we see loads and loads of families, you know, just like, we need psychological support now. This has been so traumatic, this process. You know, I speaking with consultants and the genetic counsellors in Crumlin, and they speak about families coming into them and mothers and fathers, parents who are blaming themselves and have been for the previous 3 years. What did I do wrong? You know, is it my fault? What have I done? And it's kind of, no, it's absolutely unreal. It's just a blind coincidence. It's just dumb luck, unfortunately, for many people. And yet they have been, you know, hauling themselves over the coals. And it, you know, it's a very traumatic experience, you know, thinking that I caused this and then discovering, actually, you know what, even before I was born, this was going to happen.
Yeah.
You know, that this is absolutely unrelated. There's nothing I could have done to change my life to make this a different outcome and kind of thing for my child or whatever. So, yeah, so it's incredibly important. So we're really, I guess, calling on people now to get involved in our Get Rare Aware campaign, that, you know, we need to raise the level of awareness around rare diseases. And our first stop is around this Crumlin genetics piece and getting the politicians on board to press the government to deliver on their promises.
Yeah, just in relation to the low number of people employed in core clinical genetic services, are the posts available but can't be filled, or is the funding not being made available to advertise those posts? Is that clear, Vicky?
Well, there have been posts advertised, and clinical geneticists and genetic counsellors are like hen's teeth. Everywhere in the world is trying to upskill or up their level of genetic service. So they are difficult to find. But what we have found is that, in fact, we could probably, or we should be getting in people that are at a lower kind of like, maybe in an administration, kind of like with some genetics background, but not necessarily, obviously, you know, a clinical geneticist type background, that can help to ease the process and ease the burden. So essentially, when somebody gets referred in order for the consultant to provide a proper consultation, they need to get the family history. They need to understand all of the symptoms. And so somebody's being referred in with maybe a little bit of information from a GP or a consultant, but they don't have the full picture. They don't have, in fact, you've already seen 3 or 4 different consultants and get the workup from all of the different people. And so what we're asking for now is, with each of these new regional health areas that coming with Sláintecare Care that are, I think, being launched on January 1 next year, can we embed in each of these what we're going to call a genomic resource associate? And that will be somebody that when the person gets referred in, this person will be in their area and will phone them and say, right, we need your family history. We need to know who you've been to. We need to know what other family members there are. We need to understand all of this, get the consent process and things like that all underway. So firstly, it'll reassure the people living with these conditions that actually something is happening and that there is work being undertaken. Secondly, it'll relieve all of the time of our consultants who are currently writing letters to different consultants and waiting for responses and things like that. It's such a, you know, an inappropriate use of their skills and time and expertise and things. And that's what we're trying to do. We're trying to say, right, we have a contact point now, so people living with these diseases understand that there is work being done. And also then for the people working in the area, that they can apply their expertise in the best way possible rather than chasing pieces of, you know, chasing letters and dictating letters and signing pieces of paper and stuff like that. Sure. But there must be a better way of managing this while we see this new strategy being rolled out.
Mm-hmm. Now, it's not too late, actually, for people, I think, because there might be an online element to this, if I'm correct. There is a conference at noon today. Is it being streamed online, Vicky?
It is, absolutely.
Oh, brilliant,
absolutely.
Okay.
So if people go to our website, rdi.ie, so that's the Rare Diseases Ireland website, right on the homepage, there is a link to the webinar today. So the webinar today is on at midday, and it's, you know, somebody living with that rare disease, the diagnostic journey, and then actually one of the consultants from Crumlin Genetics just speaking about their experience and what could be done and things like that. And so we'll have those two on us about midday, or it starts at midday today, and won't be too long, but we'll hopefully be interesting. And then the other thing that we are asking people to do is our Get Rare Aware, you know, the whole campaign, the idea of the campaign is to apply pressure on our elected representatives to get them to transmit that pressure onto the government to start to deliver. So we have a website, getrareaware.ie, and we're asking people to take action on that website and simply write a letter to their TDs or email a letter to their TDs. And it's very simple, it's very easy. All they need to do is put in their first and last name and their email address, and that a letter, a form letter, will then get sent to all of their elected representatives in that regional health area. And that really does help to apply pressure. We see it in other areas of life, I guess, where this happens. And it does help to apply pressure and say, listen, we're done. We're tired of waiting. There's 300,000 of us around the country. We need more support and we need it now.
All right. And listen, not everyone, people often want to help out in things, but not everyone has the money or the time to do it. But this is, neither is required really here. You can just go onto that website and back this campaign. RDI.ie, for those who want to attend virtually that conference at noon. Thanks for your time, Vicky. It's been very interesting,
hey,
enlightening.
Thank you
very much. I appreciate it. Okay, Vicky McGrath, CEO of Rare Diseases Ireland. A caller says, I was disgusted to watch Angela Scanlon Ask Me Anything show on RT last Saturday. Joining Angela on the show was Magella O'Donnell and Keith Duffy. I was shocked at the amount of profanity used and Magella talking about the use of cannabis. I don't know whether they are just trying to stay current with the young people, but it certainly didn't impress me, someone in the older demographic. Okay, I get where you're coming from. I mean, you have to talk about things as well. I don't think not talking about them isn't helpful. In terms of the language, I get where you're coming from there as well. I live in a residential area and a business recently opened beside us. The business is particularly, the business in particular has a car park, but people seem to just refuse to use it. Three times last week, someone blocked the parking space I use outside my house. One person blocked me out for over 2 hours. Can we as residents in a private cul-de-sac do anything about this? I don't know what the rules are there, actually. But the business is opened. The people aren't using the car park. Maybe a sign, a polite sign, please, private parking or reserve for residents. It seems to happen a lot around the county. Why shouldn't you do it? Morning, Greg. The listener whose son is in McGee can claim tax relief on the fees paid over and above the registration fee in Ireland. It's currently 3,000. It's probably not a huge amount, but may help a little. Okay, thank you for that, by the way. A caller says, if horse racing was banned tomorrow, every racehorse would be put down. It costs an absolute fortune to train, keep and feed racehorses. Nobody's going to keep them just as a pet. Or they could live out their natural lives. You know, I mean, there's a lot of animals that wouldn't be around if they weren't for our entertainment. There wouldn't be as many greyhounds. There wouldn't be as many dairy cows. We breed them for our purposes. We create them for our needs, don't we? Okay, but as I say, I'm not anti it. I'm just saying from a personal perspective, I watched it and it was a turn off for me. Not quite sure whether I'll take an interest in it again. Greg, I burn smokeless coal in a stove and the heat off it would put you out of the house. You see, I think there are those nuggets. There are some that are more targeted towards stoves than open fires, if I'm correct. Hi, Greg. Depending on the age of that listener's child, they might be able to do funded calls. Tell her to check out options with the tech. Okay, so that is the person whose student's going to college next year. Right, we will look into that. Maybe we need to do a little bit of a special in that regard to answer people's questions and help. I want to say happy 6th birthday to Fia Doherty from Glenfinn. Happy birthday from Mummy, Daddy, Oren and Tiernan. And there was another request there. Did I bring it in with me? No, I didn't. Anyway, if you want to, it's fine. I'll get it in a bit. If you want to send in your requests, feel free to do so. A caller says, Joe Biden's visit to Ireland has inspired me to go to the USA and see my second cousin 16 times removed who I tracked down on social media. It'll be such a surprise when I turn up at their door as they don't know me yet. Okay, sounds a bit stalky. I appreciate the tone of your text there. But, you know, we might not have a big want to feel American, but there are an awful lot of Americans because it is a young... it is a young country, you know, with, I mean, obviously we know the native history of that country, but in terms of what it is now and what they describe as America now. So they are always looking at people often are looking for, you know, where they're from. And many of them are originally or second or third generation from Ireland. So there is a big love. I don't think there's a lot of people are mad to claim connection to the USA, but certainly it does happen in reverse for no particular reason, just saying. All right, let us take a break. And we're going to be talking, actually, and this is by coincidence, Caroline, isn't it? It is just actually by coincidence. I didn't know this was coming up. We are going to be talking to someone from Animal Rising. They are the group that attempted to disrupt the Grand National. But as I say, there's not an agenda here. It just so happened that Caroline had this lined up and I was... given my views on it. Stay where you are, it should be interesting. Okay, so more than 40 animal rights activists have been de-arrested after a large number of protesters attempted to gain entry to the Aintree race course track, delaying the start of the Grand National. Merseyside police arrested 118 people on Saturday after scores of activists climbed fences, with at least two fixing themselves to a jump using glue and lock-on devices, according to the animal rights group. That group is Animal Rising. A spokesperson for it is Sarah McCafferty. She joins us now. Hi, Sarah.
Hi, thank you so much for having me on.
Good to have you with us. And as I say, I'm not coming at this for any particular angle, just so you wouldn't have been listening, but what I just felt, I've just watching it on Saturday, I kind of tuned out of it. It felt a bit, I think things have changed a little bit, but I'm not for it or against it. That's just where I'm at, if you know what I'm on about. I just thought it just... wasn't very pleasant to watch. But why did Animal Rising target this event in the manner in which it did, Sarah?
Well, firstly, we were all there because we care about the horses. And we were there to prevent direct harm coming to these animals during the races. But we were also there because this is the first of many campaigns that we have, not only this summer, but for the next, you know, years to come. This is just the beginning of protecting animals.
The comments already coming in this morning saying that, you know, a lot of these horses wouldn't even be in existence if we didn't have, you know, organised racing, that's why they're there, they're bred, they wouldn't be there at all. So how does that sit with you in that, you know, maybe you're trying to save the current crop of horses, but if you were successful in it, many, many more would not be born because there'd be no advantage in breeding them?
Well, I think this really highlights the disconnect that we have with these horses, that the only way we can imagine that they are existing is if we're using them for fun or, you know, for food as well. And so actually, if, you know, in Ireland, 92% of agriculture land is dedicated to animal farming. And if we rewilded so much of this land, then we could actually reintroduce horses, but as wild horses. So we would still have horses in Ireland, which were native to our country, yeah.
Different types of horses, though, because these are, you know, their limbs are particularly vulnerable to break and all that type of stuff, but it would be a different type of horse. And are you, like, when you say this is the start of it, right, is it horse racing now, agriculture next, like cows, dairy cows, cows reared for meat, is that also a target on the horizon?
Yeah, so, you know, Animal Rising, we're here to not only, you know, highlight and put, you know, animal, the way we treat animals in the forefront of the discussion, but actually to show the connection between our relationship to animals, how we use them for fun and for food, and how this is one of the driving causes of the climate crisis.
Yeah. What has been the public reaction to the action on Saturday?
We've had mixed responses, but as we know already before, you know, this race even began, that 80% of people under the age of 40 don't participate in racing for ethical reasons. So I think we already had quite a lot of public opinion on our side. And then by, you know, this action, by, you know, trying to prevent this race from happening, we've only increased and raised this crucial conversation within media, within our nations.
What would you say to the trainer or owner of Hill 16 who perished on Saturday? He was of the view, I didn't get to read the full article, I just skimmed it, if you know what I mean, but he seemed to be of the view that his horse died or had to be destroyed because of your actions, the actions of Animal Rising, that it distressed the horse and how he behaved, and it is for that reason that it perished.
You know, I really want to acknowledge right now, you know, how devastating that death was. That's why we were there, to prevent these horses from dying, and as well as the other two horses, you know, one at the race before and one on Thursday. So, you know, we were there to prevent these deaths from happening, but we weren't there, you know, the race before and on Thursday, and yet three horses still died, not to mention the 2,601 horses that have died since 2007. We weren't at any of those events.
Do you recognise, though, that these animals are very well cared for? I mean, there are people of a similar age to you, and perhaps even of a similar attitude, that are involved in the caring and training of these horses in the stables. You know, you can see the love that these young men and women have for these horses. I mean, do you recognise that, other than perhaps the jumping, that they are generally well cared for?
You know, I think everyone within the racing industry deeply cares for these animals. I'm not disputing that. But the fact is that one in two horses that end up in slaughter have a racing passport, which means that they've raced at some point in their life. So, you know, is this love? Is this caring for these animals once they finish racing, once they've, you know, earned people money? Then we just, you know, send them off to, you know, to be killed. That's not love. That's not caring for animals.
I don't want you to incriminate yourself. I don't know what the situation is, but as much as you can, what did you do Saturday? Like, can you talk us a little bit about how you, did you get manage yourself to gain access? What did you do? What was it like?
Yeah, absolutely. So, you know, Animal Rising, we are there and we, you know, we do this openly and accountably. So I was there and I did get arrested for trying to get onto the track. And, you know, unfortunately, we didn't make it. But some people, you know, made it onto the track, but unfortunately, we weren't able to stop the race. But we will next time, and we will keep trying, because this issue is too important not to.
How far are you prepared to go personally? Now, I don't mean in terms of inflicting any pain or injury on other people, but in terms of the sacrifice you're prepared to make. Because if that race had a big gun, if you had managed to break free, you probably would have ran out onto the course, would you have, or what? How far are you prepared to go yourself?
So I would like to, you know, remind everyone that we are a non-violent organization, which means we don't cause any harm to animals or to people. As for how far I'm willing to go, if I wanted to make it onto that track, and I would have if, you know, I hadn't been stopped and I hadn't been arrested, you know, this issue isn't about me. This isn't about...
But you're prepared to risk your own life for this cause?
Life, as I said, you know, we're a non-violent
your
movement,
own though. Yeah, so I know. I mean, I know that.
We wouldn't
not
be
with intent.
Doing that, but
if that were a consequence of it, that's how passionately you feel about this.
I am willing to risk my freedom for these animals, because this isn't just the freedom of the animals, but actually all the people that the climate crisis will affect. The IPCC report, which is the most comprehensive climate study ever conducted, said by 2050, we will have 1 to 3 billion climate refugees. This issue isn't about my freedom. This is about, you know, the freedom of all animals, you know, particularly wild animals as well, whose habitat is being destroyed, but also about all of these people that are living in countries that are being directly affected by the climate crisis now. 33 million people lost their homes in Pakistan due to climate-induced flooding.
What is next then? I mean, this sounds like, I think you are enthused by the success, as you might see it, of Saturday, right? It deferred it. It all played out. It all played out on the TV. So I think an awful lot of what you wanted to achieve other than the actual goal was achieved, right? So where does it go from here then?
Well, as I said, this is the first of many actions.
But is it more horse racing? Is it greyhounds next? Is it farms? Like, what are you? What's the plan of action?
Yeah, so we will be continuing to demonstrate at horse races, at dog races. We'll also be openly freeing animals from factory farms, as well as also continuing to do this public demonstration, you know, to really bring this conversation to the forefront of our minds and, you know, in our homes, in media and everything, and also to keep on pushing our governments to make these life-saving changes, not only to all the animals, but to the people.
How's all this being funded? I mean, who's backing you? I mean, there's a great deal of organisation and what have you has to go into this. I mean, is there an individual or an organisation that is funding this this action?
Yeah, so, well, loads of people that were there, you know, I'm a volunteer, I don't get paid to do this. So loads of it is just by people showing up and, you know, really caring about it. We do get donations, you know, everyone is able to donate to the cause at animalrising.org if, you know, but people who care about animals, they donate to, you know, sometimes do things that they're not able to do.
Right, okay.
Like get arrested, but we have all sorts of roles and responsibilities that everyone can take part in.
Are you facing charges or were you de-arrested?
I will probably be facing charges. I don't know what they are at the moment, but I was released of yesterday in the afternoon under investigation. So yeah.
And would you be part of the same group, or is there an umbrella group of those that sort of, you know, were involved in the and still continue to be the protests that disrupt traffic, you know, gluing themselves to the road and what have you? Is that the same group or under the same umbrella?
So I think you might be talking about Insulate Britain,
yeah.
Just Stop Oil. They are, you know, very climate as well as we are, you know, focused groups. We're looking at the climate crisis and how to solve that, but through animal agriculture, because animal agriculture is the leading cause of the climate crisis. Mm. And if we were to rewild our lands that are being used for animal agriculture, the UK and Ireland would become carbon neutral, negative actually, before even giving up oil and gas. So this really is the key solution to the climate crisis.
Yeah, but you know, the incredible
five actions, yeah. But you know,
that has a credible implication on people. So you don't. It's obvious. I try and avoid obvious questions, but sometimes you can't. You don't wear leather, you don't eat meat, you don't drink milk, you don't fly, presumably you don't use airplanes, you don't use a car.
So I'm vegan, so I don't, you know, use any animal products in any form.
But you didn't cycle to Aintree either, did you? I mean, like,
no.
So you used presumably, you know, internal combustion engine vehicle to get there. I mean, is that not a little bit hypocritical?
No, it's not hypocritical at all. You know, being vegan is about causing the least amount of harm possible. You know, we're not about trying to like limit people's options here. We're not saying, you know, don't drive. But what we are saying is that animal agriculture is one of the leading causes of the climate crisis. And if we were to transition to, you know, a safe and stable food system, which is plant-based, we would, you know, become carbon negative, which means we're drawing down more carbon than we're emitting before giving up oil and gas, before giving up driving. So this really is the key solution here.
Yeah, but if you were, but some might listen to that and say, well, if you were a farmer and you were making a living out of that, you might be saying, well, we need to get the cars off the road and the airplanes out of the sky, and then we'll focus on farming. Like, it sounds like some people might feel it sounds like you're an a la carte environmentalist, in that it suits you to be driven around or to fly around the place, but you're okay with that. You know, maybe it's a means to an end, but you want to disrupt something else that's quite damaging to the environment. That some people might see that as a bit hypocritical, Sarah.
I think if we look at how, you know, the difference between, you know, eating an animal and driving, I think they're very different. And I think most of your listeners will be able to understand that, you know. Also, this isn't just about, you know, taking away someone's, you know, right, as you put it, or choice, but actually we're taking away the choices of animals every single day. You know, they're not our lives to take. We're not giving up anything. We're just not taking something that isn't ours. And, you know, I think if we were to choose between, you know, eating a healthy plant-based diet and driving, I think they're very different. And I think the public understands that.
Yeah. And finally, what do you think can be achieved by this? Like, do you, I mean, I can't imagine horse racing ever being banned. Or can you?
Absolutely. Yeah, I wouldn't be taking part in the actions that I do if I didn't believe that we can put a complete stop to these, you know, these cruel sports. But I would like to, you know, remind people that we also at one point in history thought dog fighting was okay, and that bull sports were okay. And when we looked at them from a compassionate point of view, we decided as society that this was not acceptable anymore, and we moved away from these sports. We are absolutely able to move away from horse racing and from, you know, animal farming, animal agriculture, etc.
All right. So what is the next? I don't really follow horse racing. What's the next big meet? Like, are you going to be going to the, you know, the Cheltenhams and you've done Aintree, or is it, you know, some horse race meet in 7:30 on a Tuesday evening? Like, have you got a plan of action that you can make public at this point?
Yeah, so we'll be there at the bigger events and at the smaller ones as well. And we will be at, as I said before, dog racing. But I would like to remind everyone here that this isn't just about horse racing. This is about the much wider conversation about the way that we treat animals for fun and for food. You know, 99% of animals that are in existence right now are in the food industry.
Okay, well, we'll see what the listeners think. Thanks for your time this morning. I appreciate it.
Thank you for having me.
As I say, trying to avoid obvious questions, but some things just, you know what I mean? They're just so in your face, you have to mention it. I appreciate your time, Sarah. Take care of yourself.
Thank you.
Okay, bye-bye. Sarah McCafferty there, who's a spokesperson for Animal Rising. What do you think? 086 60 25,000. Maybe, you know, there's not a massive amount of engagement in horse racing, for example, amongst the public in younger people, or is there? Sarah seems to think there isn't. Maybe it's naturally going to ebb away. I don't know. I am here learning and forming my opinions on the hoof, so to speak. No pun intended, but sure, look it. All right, some of your comments here. A caller wants to know who is funding Animal Rising. I asked that question, actually, so hopefully you heard the answer. Greg, those horses are cared for a reason, to make millions for the owners and trainers. By the way, I haven't watched horse racing in almost 40 years. Another, the caller says, horse racing is a multi-billion industry to Ireland. These horses get more care than humans. Horses are more at risk out in fields from falls and getting hit by other horses. I saw an interesting statistic as it relates to the actual benefit to Ireland of horse racing. I don't want to misquote the figures. Might try and dig them out again. By the way, I want to be really clear here. This is a platform where we all talk about things and, you know, have opinions and exchange the views. I'm not in any way sort of trying to campaign or join a campaign to ban horse racing or farming or anything for that matter. It's just to have the conversation. An owner had a horse who was winning everything at Cheltenham. The horse was found dead in the field the next morning after the race, after he was hit by another horse. Okay, they're coming into us thick and fast. Keep them coming into us.